Good afternoon. Welcome along. It's Saturday here on Premier Christian Radio. That means one thing. It is, of course, the show where Christians and non-Christians get together to talk. So welcome along, however you're listening to us today. And it's great to have you with me. Not long to go till Easter. I'll be telling you about our Easter programming coming up a little later on in the program. But right now, let's get on with the show that gets Christians and non-Christians talking. You're unbelievable. And today we've got the second part of the programme where we've had David Robertson and Adrian Hayter on. They were with me last week. David Robertson is a pastor in Scotland. He's written a book called The Dawkins Letters, Challenging Atheist Myths. And we're going to be discussing some more of those so-called atheist myths with Adrian Hayter today, our atheist blogger. That's the way he goes online. We're going to be looking today at what David calls the myth of godless morality. And also, putting them in one, the myth of the immoral Bible and the cruel Old Testament God. So are atheists guilty of believing in these mythical things? We'll find out from David Robertson, who's our Christian on the show, and Adrian Hayter, our atheist, on Unbelievable. So we've had lots of response to last week's show when these gentlemen joined me. They'll be coming on shortly, but first of all, we'll get through some of that feedback and see what you thought of last week's programme. Some really interesting responses. But before we get to those particular ones, let me just get through some other issues. Perhaps you're one of the many people now who listen via podcast or go to the Unbelievable webpage at premier.org.uk/unbelievable to listen back to the show. I've had an inquiry here from Pastor Sergey, who says, "Hi, I'm wondering, is it possible to download a podcast to my computer so I can listen to the show without being connected to the internet, or is it only available when we're online?" Well, just to give you the idea here, and it looks like you're emailing from another country, Pastor Sergey, so I don't know what your internet connection is like out there. But essentially, yes, you can download the podcast as an MP3 file, and then you can listen to that whenever you want without having to be connected to the internet, though obviously you have to be connected to download it in the first place. The other option is to listen, as it were, to the streamed version, which you can find straight on the page at premier.org.uk/unbelievable and the archive there. But if you want to get the MP3, i.e. the podcast, then go to the Unbelievable webpage, premier.org.uk/unbelievable, and you can click on the link that says Get the Podcast, and that'll give you a page which is the audio feed, essentially. You can either download straight from there the MP3s, or you can put that audio feed, if you like, web title into your MP3, whatever particular software you use, and it will automatically download the show week by week. A lot of people use iTunes, of course. That's the way that lots of people do that. You can also go to the iTunes store and search for Unbelievable, Premier, Podcast, those kinds of words, and you'll also be able to subscribe directly through iTunes. So various ways to do it. Actually, it's just been interesting. The podcast has been growing in popularity over the last year or so, and I thought I'd give you a rundown, for those who are interested in this kind of thing, of our most popular programmes, five most popular programmes when it comes to the podcast statistics. So thanks very much to Steve Maltz, who is our technical guru on this side, who provides me with these statistics. Out in first place, and just shows what a popular programme this has been, because it's only been available since the beginning of this year. It was the Bart Ehrman Peter Williams debate called Misquoting Jesus on Bart Ehrman's book of the same title. That was on the 3rd of January that went out, and many, many people have downloaded that since it's kind of got into cyberspace, as people have mentioned it on their blogs, etc. Coming up in second, not far behind, is Christianity on Trial Part 1. That was broadcast on the 6th of September 08. That was between atheist Ed Turner and Andy Bannister, looking at whether we can trust the Bible and what it says about the Christian faith. Why Believe in Jesus, a similar sort of program, in number three. That's Amy Orr Ewing, who's a well-known apologist with the Ravi Zacharias Trust, debating Norman Hansen, a former Christian. That's available at the show of the 18th of October. Coming up at number four, our fourth most popular download, has been the review I did of the Dawkins-Lennox debate in Oxford that happened in October last year. That went out on the 8th of November. So again, that's been very popular. And fifthly, the Darwin versus Design program, featuring intelligent design expert Tom Woodward from the States debating Peter Harty, an atheist with an interest in biology. That was from the 30th of August, the summer of last year. So there you go, our top five programmes. But out there at number one is that Misquoting Jesus programme. If you haven't listened to it or to any of those programmes as they strike your interest, do check them out at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. You can listen, as I say, directly via the streaming capacity on that website, or you can download the MP3, listen at your own convenience. So there you go. Thank you very much for getting in touch, though, Sir Jay. Let's look at some of the response to previous programmes. The DNA and the Origin of Life show of a few weeks back, thanks to Devin, who says the show with on the DNA and the Origin of Life, the Cosmic Fingerprints of God with Peter Marshall and Peter Harty, Perry Marshall and Peter Harty, was one of the best shows I have heard. One of the best cases for design I've ever heard. Keep up the great work. Thank you very much, Devin. Nick wanted to say about our show from last week with David Robertson, it was one of the best displays I'd seen, but particularly wanted to comment on one of the letters I read before that show started. The atheist asking, who designed the designer? And you say, Nick, I can't believe people use this completely fallacious argument. There are things that do not have designers, first off, by the nature of what they are. For instance, are the laws of logic design? Second off, he asked how it could have happened that there could be an uncaused being. Well, to ask how an eternal being could happen would be a category fallacy. I'm constantly amazed that atheists still put this argument forward. On a similar lines, Garrett in South Carolina wanted to comment on the program where we looked at the fine-tuning of the universe, and particularly that same email that I read out last week. You say, Garrett, when Christians appeal to the need of a creator, they're doing so because of the principle of causality. This principle states that every finite effect needs a cause, and no effect can be greater than its cause. An infinite effect cannot have a cause because an infinite has no beginning or end. For example, if the universe was infinite, it couldn't have had a beginning or cause. Also, an infinite cannot be made up of ordered parts, because an infinite number of finite parts is impossible. And you go on to give an analogy. How many marbles does it take to create an infinite pile of marbles? Well, it's not possible, because no matter how large the pile, you could always add one more marble. Well, you say then the universe has been determined to be finite upon many lines of evidence. Its limited size, it is expanding, its limited age, it's made up of ordered parts, to name just a few. Therefore, the finite universe needs an infinite cause, i.e. God, to account for its existence and order. You say, I learned most of these concepts from Dr. Norman Geisler in seminary and can't understand why others aren't using the arguments. Let me know what you think. Well, I agree. As well as Norman Geisler, that someone who I think has proved this very categorically, as far as I'm concerned, is William Lane Craig, who, of course, his Kalam argument, cosmological argument, very much based on this kind of idea of anything that begins to exist needs a cause, and to prevent an infinite regress, it has to be an infinite uncaused cause. So anyway, interesting stuff. Thank you very much for getting in touch. Now, as regards last week, David Robertson and Adrian Hayter, who we'll be meeting in a moment again for round two, as it were, they were talking about atheist myths, in particular, the atheist myth of rationality and tolerance. And we went into religious child abuse and other things. So we'll be hearing round two shortly. Here's some of your responses by phone to that programme of last week.
Hello, my name is Louisa Taylor. I remember the adverts that they had on the buses, there probably isn't a God. Stop worrying about it and live your life. At first, I did find those adverts were offensive, but I did like the Christian response where some churches released adverts themselves and there was like space to debate. I did enjoy the show very much, the conversation that was going on, and I think it was a great thing for it to be on television today. If the atheist, if she hasn't read Richard Dawkins' God Delusion, she should read it, because there are offensive comments in it.
Hello, my name's Patrick, and I'm still waiting to hear a coherent argument coming from an atheist. It could be unbelievable. He mentions about something about Noah's Ark and killing all the people on the earth and all the rest of it, apart from eight people, and giving the impression, oh, God's a bad God, this, that, and the other. Well, I suppose that's understandable, but that sort of argument does not disprove him. that he exists. It just proves what type of God he is.
Hello there. Hi, my name's Avril. I'm from Northern Ireland. I was just listening to your program there, and the first that came to mind was, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. And it was just for the atheist. There is another verse. It was Matthew chapter 11, verse 25. And it says, I thank thee, O Father, Lord of heaven and earth, that you have hid your words from the wise and prudent and revealed it unto babes. It was just when they were saying the atheist was more intelligent. And I am really enjoying your program. All right, see you. Bye.
Well, thank you very much for getting in touch with us on that program of last week. If you want to phone in regard to today's round two, as we meet our guests again, then do phone 08456 525252 and select option 5, or you can email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Just like John Miller did, he says it was a really excellent programme. Premier Radio is very best. Thank you also, Michael, who agreed listening in his car. Ken in Azusa in California says that the way that the atheists last week talked about intolerance doesn't make sense. First, asserting that homosexuality is genetic is an unproven claim, and then to say that those who oppose homosexual acts are intolerant. Well, you ask, how do they know this? If there is no one outside of evolved creatures to provide a basis for making ethical decisions, they have no business using the intolerant word. Even if they are correct that some attitude is intolerant, why is that a problem? Should we accept rape and stop being intolerant about it? If you exclude God, you have no reason to assert moral values. It's hypocritical, says Ken. I think that really ties into something we'll be looking at in the programme today with David and Adrian, Ken. The myth of godless morality. That's certainly something we'll be kicking off with. So I hope you enjoy it as you listen today. Finally, this was really interesting. Richard Morgan emailed to say, I've just finished listening to last week's programme, Challenging Atheist Myths. At one point, David Robertson mentioned a atheist who turned up on their Free Church website announcing that he'd been converted. Well, here I am. I am that former atheist, and I will be celebrating my first Christian birthday on April the 12th, and I can assure you I have had an astounding year. Maybe you would like to have a glance at my conversion story as published in the Free Church of Scotland magazine. I did have a look at that, and it is a very interesting story. And I'll put the link for that with this show on the Unbelievable webpage. So if you want to find out more about Richard Morgan's story, former atheist, very much part of the Dawkins Net community, how he came to Christ, I'll pop a link on there. Thank you for getting in touch, and let's meet our guests for the second time.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
And on the show today, second part of last week's show, as we welcome back into the studio David Robertson, author of The Dawkins Letters, Challenging Atheist Myths. He's a minister in Scotland. He's got a church there, but he has time as well to do various talks and debates around the country, particularly in response to The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins. Also with us from last week, Adrian Hayter, who is the atheist blogger, is the term that you use for yourself, Adrian. So you're obviously a man who loves technology, computers, etc. In fact, very much part of what you do is kind of making it easier for atheists to communicate online and that sort of thing. You're into the technological side of things.
I have a blog about atheism and religion and God, and I also run a set of atheist forums where we have just discussions on theology and atheism and God and religion. And we run a book club on that as well. So
we kind of got the short version of your story last week, but maybe we'll go into a bit more depth this time. I mean, would you have described your upbringing as a Christian one, or perhaps nominally Christian in some sense? I don't know.
I would have said it was almost Christian light.
Christian light.
Christian light. It was. My mother was Christian. My grandmother was Christian. We lived with my grandmother. I'm not sure about my dad. I haven't really asked him. I don't think he probably was a Christian at that time. But we went to church at the major festivals, Easter and Christmas, and occasionally on a Sunday, as far back as I can remember. And I was christened, and obviously it was kind of like a Christian upbringing, I guess. We went to a Church of England school. We had our re-lessons.
But I'm thinking, you weren't in that sense committed Christians, though.
It wasn't like
church every Sunday and prayers around the meal and that sort
no,
of thing.
It wasn't
that kind of an issue. I mean, but you made a conscious decision at some point, whatever Christian influence you did have in your life, you were going to reject. And interestingly, you said last week that actually happened in a church. What exactly spurred you to think that way?
I was nine at the time. That's all I can remember. I was nine at the time. And I don't remember the direct sermon that was going on, but I think the preacher was obviously talking about God and Jesus, and I just, you know, made the realization I don't believe this is true. So obviously at nine you turn to your mother to say something, and I was like, I don't believe in God. I don't think I do. And she told me to, you know, well, this isn't the place to discuss this sort of thing. Just carry on listening or do something else. I don't know. So that was kind of like the first sort of like atheism sort of thing that came to my life. And then obviously I went to a grammar school where it was actually a grammar school next to Salisbury Cathedral, Bishop Wordsworth School. And I went there, and it was obviously quite a religious school. They've got a chapel there. They have monthly services in the cathedral. There's a lot of prayer in assemblies and everything like that. But I met a few people there who were atheists, and we just talked and I got on, and I just really discovered that you could have this nice life without God or without Jesus.
Mm. Indeed, I'm sure many people, have nice lives without God or Jesus involved in them. I mean, you've particularly chosen, though, whereas most people probably don't really give it much thought. You've specifically, you know, you're the one who wears the atheist badges on your jacket, I've seen, that say evolved and whatnot. I mean, do you, in some sense, are you then reacting to, do you think there is a danger from religion, from Christianity, that atheists need to get together, band together and speak out and make their cause known?
I think atheists need to get together. The word needs to come out that we are there, because obviously Christians have been doing it for many, many, many years. And it's just, you know, it's all about having views, discussing, obviously, this programme. I'm very glad to be invited on it. So it's a programme discussing belief with non-believers.
Mm.
So that's what it's all about. It's really just, you know, getting these atheists out. And because of some atheist discrimination, obviously not in this country, but obviously in America, you've only got one member of Congress who is openly atheist. And so it's more of an issue over there that you need to get these people. And I think a recent survey suggested there was 16% of Americans would call themselves non-religious, mainly atheist. So I think, yeah, it's definitely important because we are an increasingly large number of people. And I think all views need to be shown.
I mean, so you're really there because you do feel that the atheist point of view needs representation, that it's in some sense underrepresented in our society or...
Underrepresented and probably misunderstood a lot.
Okay.
I think most of the focus of a lot of Christians these days is on anti-theism, and so, which is completely different to atheism, obviously. And
I saw a picture of you on your blog with Richard Dawkins. Yes. Has he had a kind of big impact on your own thinking?
Yeah, well, I mean, I was obviously an atheist before the book came out. I don't think I didn't hear about the book for several years after it came out, and I purchased it and read it, and I just thought, yeah, that's, you know, there's some good arguments in here, there's some bad arguments in here, but I understand what he's trying to do. He's trying to talk to atheists, trying to encourage them to get out and be militant.
Mm.
Which I think, you know, obviously militant atheism, it's not really about, like, I don't know, marching to war or anything like that. It's more about getting the view out there and making an impact.
I mean, but is the ultimate end to that Richard Dawkins' end, which is that he would like to see religion banished? You know, well, not banished in that sense, but disappear, at least. I mean, that's your ultimate goal, is you think religion is irrational, the world is better off without irrational beliefs, ergo, religion, it would be better if it didn't exist.
Well, I wouldn't say that in all of religion is irrational. I'd say that definitely creation myths, obviously, are quite irrational. We have scientific explanations for how everything got here. I think that should definitely disappear. Maybe keep it as a nice fairy tale story, almost, to tell children when they're younger. But I think definitely religion should be reduced. Not obviously, I don't want to. I mean, P.Z. Myers is a biologist blogger, quite a famous atheist biologist blogger. He said he'd like to see religion as something like knitting, something you do at the weekend. And you don't really.
I think that's how a lot of people really view it in the UK. To be honest, I think a lot of people see it as a weekend activity if you're into that sort of thing.
Yeah, but something you don't really press. You know, I mean, you don't have a society of knitters going to the government and saying, "Oh, we reckon this should be banned or something like that."
Well, I don't know if you've ever thought of taking up knitting, David, but it's a possible alternative to your role as a Christian minister. Just again, a quick resume of yourself for those who may be listening for the first time this week. You wrote the Dawkins letters, kind of in response. I mean, not originally as a book, but actually as a series of letters. I think published on a website. Was that correct?
Yeah, they're published on the website, and I actually didn't know there was a Dawkins website. And the first of those got published on the Dawkins website. It was lifted and put on there, and it got a phenomenal reaction. And I started getting lots of emails from atheists, and I was so impressed that they were reading the Free Church website. And then somebody wrote and said...
It's because you've been linked.
Yeah, I would like to apologise for all the nasty things they're saying about you. And I hadn't a clue. I said, well, what are you talking about? And he said, oh, you don't know, go to the Dawkins website. And I came across such wonderful quotes as, my sister loved this. She phoned up laughing one time. Got a quote 333 or something. It was, David Robertson is an arrogant, moronic retard. He doesn't know how to argue. The Sky Ferry is coming. Watch out, David. He'll be late. He has the intellectual capacity of roadkill. I still think that's one of the best insults I've ever been given.
That's very creative.
It was. Yeah, I was pretty impressed. There's some other...
You didn't put that review on the back jacket or anything?
Well, actually, I wanted to put it on the front, but they wouldn't let me do it. But they did. They did let me put some on the internal ones, which were... but this is another one I thought was quite good. Robertson is a prat, and not only a prat, but a dangerous prat, a complete loser. I've never read such a dogmatic, vicious diatribe as this. When will theists like Robertson actually provide some empirical evidence of their own, something we can really scrutinise and say, hey, you know, there could be a God judged on this evidence? And someone else. There are other people who, I mean, there's a mixture of good and bad quotes, you know, people saying, I don't agree with you, but at least you've taken the time to read it and respond.
Interestingly, one contributor on the website did say that they thought your book was the best response to Dawkins of the of the what they call flea bites.
The flea books.
I mean, in a sense, you've kind of, as you said last week, targeted it at those who may be sceptical, but maybe not completely close-minded. And part of that is kind of looking at the particular assumptions of atheism is kind of what you might call it, and you've termed them myths.
Yes.
And we're going to look today in the programme at the myths of godless morality, and also, kind of lumping them together somewhat, the myth of the immoral Bible and the cruel Old Testament God. As we're carrying on from last week, I think we were going to also sort of maybe pick up on some of the things we'd sort of finished the show with last week. But that's the show as it stands, and we look forward to this interaction on the programme. Once again, my guests are David Robertson and Adrian Hayter. You can find links to their shows, to their own web pages, I should say, online with this programme if you go to premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And, why not invest in a copy of David's book as well, The Dawkins Letters, available via the Premier shop, premier.org.uk/shopping. We'll be back in a couple of minutes' time as we continue our debate from last week, and I hope you'll be with us too in a couple of minutes.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
It's a second bite of the cherry for my guests today. Returning from last week with Adrian Hayter, our atheist, and David Robertson, our Christian, as we look at more sections from David's book, The Dawkins Letters, particularly looking at the myth of godless morality and the myth of the immoral Bible and the cruel Old Testament God. That's our subject on the show that gets Christians and non-Christians talking Unbelievable. So you'd like Christianity to become a sort of a quaint pastime to fill in the odd hour, rather like knitting,
As much as you don't get people forming like massive groups of knitters to go and storm Parliament and say, well, we need this bill through, or you know, we want our views held up as a democracy.
Do you think Christians are wrong for wanting their views to be represented in Parliament?
Not represented, but I think as the absolute view, as in this has to be, you know, or Christian groups that are, like, say, against abortion for obvious reasons. They're against abortion because they think, you know, this conception is when the soul emerges or whatever, and that's when life begins. But obviously there's other people who would say, well, no, that's not what we think and that's not what happened. So you've got two conflicting opinions, and you've got these pressure groups from all the Christians saying, you know, we can't have abortion. But what I'd like is like a balanced view, so you don't have the oppressiveness. You have a group of knitters, for instance.
Okay, just who aren't going to complain about much. I mean, what was your view on the whole knitting analogy there, David?
I just feel like I should be bringing out my needles right now. I think, Adrian, that you're wanting something that you've rejected, because it appears to me from your introduction that the knitting version of Christianity is what you had, and it was just useless. And you want us all to become as useless as that. I think it's a bit like the flu jab. You know, in school they give you a wee, or if you're an older person, they give you a wee flu jab, which gives you a small dose of the flu so you don't get the real thing. And I think that's what you're suggesting in terms of religion. Now, of course, Dawkins is, and others are arguing for privatised religion. In that case, I would argue for privatised secularism or privatised atheism. In other words, please don't bring any of your atheist views into public life. So don't say anything about abortion, don't say. Of course, that's a nonsense. You couldn't do that. I think, again, this comes back to what we were last week, the intolerance, which is saying the only viewpoint that's allowed in public life is the secular viewpoint. Because it's true that knitters do not blockade Parliament demanding that Jerry Springer and his opera, The Knitting Massacre, should be banned. Neither did knitters blockade Parliament and work for 30 years to ban slavery, whereas Christians did. I think that asking us to privatise our religion is as ridiculous as asking that the secularist viewpoint be privatised or the atheistic viewpoint be privatised. So I just wouldn't go there. But by the way, I do agree with you on the amount of atheists. I actually think most people in this country and in the United States live as functional atheists. Whatever they say, they live as if there were no God. And I know that I'm in a minority, and I don't care, because know the truth and the truth will set you free, as they say. So I just think that, but I love this idea that you portray of atheists needing to get the word out. I'm not aware of a single Christian newspaper in Britain. I'm not aware of the BBC or others having a particularly religious agenda, and the kind of religion they often put on is so innocuous as to be what you were describing, the flu that stops you getting the flu. I'm actually quite impressed with your testimony, because what I would suggest is you need to keep investigating and you'll maybe get the real thing instead of what you had before.
Yeah, I mean, one other thing that you wanted to pick up on from last week's programme was towards the end, David had been talking about Dawkins' assertion that, to feed a child views on a particular religious point of view is tantamount to child abuse, even sexual child abuse. He came under a lot of flack, actually, Dawkins, for that particular statement. People who have their children in faith schools, I mean, it seems ridiculous to say that they're abusing them in some way. I mean, where do you stand on that whole issue,
well,
Adrian?
Before I answer that, just coming back to David's point, I mean, in a secular society, I would definitely campaign for atheism to be also just reduced to knitting. I don't think we should. I think a secular society is going to have all views and opinions talked about, and then the conflicting ones, we're just going to say, no, we're not going to have any conflicting ones. We're just going to focus on, you know, what's right, or what we interpret as right.
How would you know what's right?
Well,
how would you interpret it? What would be the boundaries?
the boundaries would be what is better for humanity, what is good for humanity, and abortion is better for humanity in the way that it's a choice. You need
who says it's better for humanity?
The fact that if a person is raped, there and it's going to destroy their life, a baby, because they're going to be reminded of the constant rape, and it's just going to be harder for the parent. If they have the choice, it's a choice. Remember, we're not saying if you get raped you have to have an abortion. We're saying if you get raped you have the choice to abort the child because of this of the pressures of having this child and raise this child, which because a constant reminder of horrible crime.
Well, leave aside the rape because it's always dangerous to take extreme cases, and I mean exceptions make bad laws. I personally don't think it is an exception. I think when you know people who were the product of rape, you don't turn around and just say to them, well, actually you should have been dead because you're such a burden to your mother. I think that's a ridiculous point of view and it's not scientific. But given that, you know, we're talking here about how we make choices. Leaving aside the 0.04% or whatever that are rapes or absolutely very severe handicap, you are then suggesting that the 99% of abortions that go on in Britain should actually not be allowed.
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying
they be allowed?
I'm saying it's a choice.
What if I choose to kill Peter Singer, the philosopher in the United States, argues that if you have a severely handicapped child who's not in the womb, you should be entitled to kill that child.
Yeah, and I disagree with Peter Singer.
But why? That's a choice.
But it's the fact that you've got this. Well, I disagree with him as in I think only if I only agree with abortion if the mother's life is in danger or if they've been raped. I think that they're the only two sort of like ways in which you can go about getting an abortion. I think people who just, you know, get an abortion for the hell of it, or just, you know, or they just sleep around for the hell of it, get pregnant, and then saying, oh, it's okay, I'll just get an abortion. I think that's it's not a very positive attitude to take for abortion.
Yes, but what you're doing there, and I agree with you. I mean, I think that's, I actually think, I mean, I would be against all abortion, to be honest, except when the mother's life was in danger. But, I mean, I agree with a lot of what you're saying. It makes sense. But the difficulty is other people who will turn around and say, but no, our society doesn't think like that. Our society at the moment allows the vast majority of abortions to occur because it's inconvenient for the mother or the parents or whatever. And how do we make those kind of decisions, you see? And that's the problem, because I would argue that what is happening is that people are not leaving their beliefs and so on at the door when it comes to making public decisions. It's precisely because of those beliefs that they make those decisions. So why is it that Christians should be mocked and derided and excluded from voting or from arguing for things to be done because of what we believe, when non-Christians are very, very happy to put what they believe into practice in the public sphere?
Well, I mean, I think there definitely needs to be some regulation on abortion. I think it's just got out of hand in a lot of countries. Mm-hmm. We've legalised it. But the fact is you've got this, obviously, this issue of choice. You know, it's if there's any argument for abortion to be legalised, then that's the argument we should take, because you've got the people who actually want it. The Christians who campaign against it say, oh, it's wrong, morally wrong, whatever. You say, okay, that's your belief, so don't get an abortion. That's your right as a citizen to not get an abortion. If you've got people who want to get an abortion because they were raped or because, you know, the woman's life's in danger, the choice should be available. So it's really just it's Christians who, you know, mm-hmm. argue. It's Christians who say, gay marriage is wrong. The Bible says whatever, therefore gay marriage should be illegal. And my response to that is, well, don't get a gay marriage then. If you believe that, don't get a gay marriage.
But you see, the interesting thing here is we're back to the mantra of choice and how we make decisions. And this is where the whole godless morality thing comes in. Because let's say the same thing about slavery. You don't believe in slavery, don't get a slave. The same argument. And it's a choice. It's a choice whether you have a slave or not. Now, my argument with that, or the same with prostitution. You don't believe in prostitution, don't go out and buy a prostitute. But I would argue slavery is wrong. Prostitution is wrong, whether you want to make that choice or not. And the argument is not about choice in terms of abortion. And the argument is not about when the soul comes. The argument is about human life. And the irony is, the more we know about human life since the Abortion Act was passed in 1967, that the more we know about human life in the womb, the more we realize that there is life. And I think it is a perfectly legitimate position for a Christian or anyone else to say we should not take life, whether in the womb or out of it. My concern is, on what basis does a secularist government say, no, we can take life within the womb, but we can take it out? Singer is actually being more consistent than our governments. So I think Christians are perfectly entitled to campaign against abortion without being ridiculed as, oh, they're all a bunch of religious nutters. And that's where we come back to what we were doing last week, the irrationality and the intolerance. Because it is assumed I am against abortion because I've had some command from God on high.
Why does this whole thing tie in then to the godless morality thing? Because, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, a lot of people, I think, are worried when they hear Christians say atheism leads to, you know, immorality. That they say, well, that's ridiculous. Yeah. Atheists are just as moral people as Christians, if not more so very often. What's the actual argument you're making?
Yeah, this it's hugely important to get this right. I mean, I think the argument for morality is, I agree with C.S. Lewis. It's a bigger argument than the argument from creation for the existence of God. I mean, it is the argument within. I think it's the argument that absolutely convinced Francis Collins, the head of the Human Genome Project, when he read Lewis's thing. We know that morality exists. If you are an absolute empirical rationalist, then you are going to be... You cannot disagree with Bertrand Russell's statement after the Second World War, when on a BBC radio programme he said, Dachau is wrong is not a fact. I think it was wrong, but it's not a fact in the same way as gravity is a fact. On the other hand, I approach it with a different point of view. I say Dachau is wrong is a fact. Raping my daughter is a fact. Is wrong is a fact. I then work back from that fact to work out why it's wrong, and I think actually that does lead me to absolute morality, which then leads me to an absolute God. As Dawkins himself says, absolute morality is almost impossible.
What do you think Dawkins' view is on this? What comes out for you from the God delusion? Yeah. What are you responding to, in the book?
Well, you see, I think he's arguing against, again, a straw man as well, because, again, this is important. I am not saying that Christianity is moralism. I think lots of people equate Christianity with moralism. You go to church, perhaps as you were going, Adrian, as a nine-year-old, and the vicar stands up and says, be nice, help old ladies across the road, give a pound to Oxfam, don't lie, you know, all these things. Now, my argument is that by definition of being human, every human being is made in the image of God, every human being has the law of God written on their hearts, every human being is moral. There are some people who are religious who behave in an appallingly immoral way. And there are other people who are not religious and who are not Christians who behave in a much more Christian way. So I am not saying we need the Bible or we need religion to make people moral. I'm saying that people are moral. But what I want to argue is I think that there is no basis for morality, for understanding it or consistency in it, without recognizing where it comes from. In other words, for there to be a morality at all, it must be an absolute. If it's to be an absolute morality, at least it must derive from an absolute morality. If there is an absolute morality, where does that come from? And for me, that is, we are literally and metaphorically on the road to hell once we reject the concept of an absolute morality.
I don't know whether you've sort of considered much of this argument yourself, Adrian. What do you make of this idea that if we believe that things are either right or wrong, there must be a lawgiver who says this is right and this is wrong, that we don't just live in a kind of... Because we all seem to believe that that some things are fact about morality, that Dachau was wrong.
Well, yeah, I mean, there certainly are rights and wrongs. I don't think they can be considered facts. I mean, Hitler thought that what he was doing was right. So, I mean, that must have been a fact to him. So I think that what we've got here is a lot of different facts, a lot of different opposing facts that are gradually changing over time. Well, that seems to me that it's not fact at all. It's a lot of opinion. And if you look back enough and look at the development of society and look at human beings as a species, you'll see that morality is a gradually evolved thing. We are very social creatures. We've known this for hundreds and millions of years. If we look back in time at our ancestors, we see that they lived in groups, you know, and even our closest living relatives, the great apes, they live in groups. They have some level of morality between them. Animals that live in groups don't just randomly kill each other. You know, they have to have a pack instinct. And I think the same can be said almost of humans. Except we've developed this idea that, you know, as we live in a society, there are some things that we can't do because they're not beneficial to society. For instance, I mean, murder is an instant one. You can't allow murder in society because if you allow murder, someone goes around murdering everybody and you have no society left. Rape is another one because rape causes the harm to women, and then you've got women who are depressed and there's just all this emotion going on, and it just leads to families splitting up and everything like that, and that's a bad thing for society. And it's also it hurts the woman and it hurts society in that way. And same with stealing. You can argue stealing from a purely evolutionary perspective. You can't have a society where we allow stealing because then everybody just starts having basically a war. So I think there is a relative
morality. Our morality is simply an aspect of what has allowed our society to be a better society.
Yes, and us as a species, I think you can make a good argument from us being a species to us having a morality, as you can for a lot of animals in the animal kingdom.
There you go, David. Our morality is a factor of our evolutionary story.
Well, it's interesting that that this line gets taken because, you know, Adrian said you can't allow murder. Actually, we've just been talking about abortion. Some of us consider that to be murder, so we can allow it. You can, and I mean, what Adrian is saying is certainly Dawkins' position in the God delusion, where his case for morality is kinship and reciprocal altruism. You know, we're bound together in a pack, in the pack mentality. If you've ever been at a football ground in England and in Scotland, sadly, I think you want to avoid the herd mentality, actually. It can be very dangerous. I'm very concerned about the herd mentality. That did exist and was cut loose in Nazi Germany as well. But you've got that. You've got, perhaps we're genetically programmed to say, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. And then Dawkins brings in the whole idea of reputation, self-advertisement. You know, Bill Gates gives X amount of money, everyone knows, people, you know, it's kind of... The trouble with all of that is this, that morality, as I list in my own book in the chapter on it, is it's back to the selfish gene, it's deterministic. In other words, it is, I just can't help it. There's not free will and choice. And that's, it's fascinating that Dawkins does not discuss free will at all. And yet, in a human society, we are not just genetically programmed. Again, Adrian has been going on and on and on about choices. But if we don't have free will, do we have choices? You see, that's another issue. And therefore, how can you judge anything for anyone? I'm very, very, very concerned about these arguments. Adrian, I read your website, and I have to say this to those who are listening, that... of all the atheist websites I've read, PJ Myers is the top for entertainment and information. You're right. Yours I've found to be the most gracious and interesting. And I'd actually read it before I'd heard you were coming on this program, because for some reason you're out there in blogosphere. But on your website you say, if a group allowed murder, it would die out quickly. Actually, no. Darwinian evolution. What was the subtitle for Darwin's book, The Origin of the Species? It was how one race advances against another. It could be genetically and societally enormously advantageous for a group to kill off its weak. I've seen that in the animal world. My father was a pig farmer, and sometimes you'd see a mother sow eat a weak and young pig. Yeah. So it doesn't follow that group allowing murder, it would die out quickly. In fact, it probably goes the other way. You say in your blog as well, the rape and murder of a young girl is wrong because it does not do anything to advance our society. I think that's probably true. It doesn't do anything to advance our society. But what if it did? If it did something to advance our society, would that make it right? And for me, the answer is no. Even if it did something to advance our society, I quote, let me just mention this guy, Bill Hamilton, who was Richard Dawkins' mentor in biology. An extraordinary guy. He once said this, that this is not a crazed lunatic. This is one of the major evolutionary biologists and atheistic. I think he's this because of his atheism rather than his evolutionism. But he said he had more sympathy for a lone fern than he did for a crying child. He argued that males were largely doomed to compete and that the purpose of sex was to clean out the gene pool by filtering out the useless and the weak. The low-status male would be better off dead. Everything in nature, according to Hamilton, could be explained as the outcome of competition between genes. So he argued for a radical program of infanticide, eugenics, and euthanasia to save the world. He believed that modern medicine was doing harm by allowing the weak to survive and thus preserving their genes. And the two arguments he gave for that were cesarean sections and the glasses worn by John Maynard Smith. Spectacles are a symbol of decadence within the gene pool. And as for cesarean sections, women should be allowed one and then only to save the mother's life. After that, they should be paid not to have any more children. He also argued that working-class women should have less children and upper-class women should have better. He said that genocide was a result of overbreeding and he would grieve more for the death of one giant panda than he would for 100 unknown Chinese. If he had a handicapped baby on Robinson Crusoe's island, I would kill it with my own hands. Now, who's to say he's wrong? I say he's wrong because I think that goes against God's law and I think it goes against everything that makes us human. But scientifically, who is to say he's wrong? And that's my concern with the position that is being taken on morality.
Well, yes, I would say scientifically, yes, there is nothing wrong, but I don't think, as you say, science doesn't tell us what is right or wrong. That's down to what we consider ethics. And I think in a bizarro universe where raping a young girl is beneficial to society, I think if our morality would have evolved so that raping young women was considered right. That's what I think. I think that's the only logical reasoning you can get for that. That a society that knew that raping young women is beneficial would rape young women because it benefits society.
But that's what happened. In Stalin's Russia, for example, when if you read books about, for example, the invasion of Berlin, there's several I've read recently by the Russians. The Russian soldiers were positively encouraged to rape as many German women as possible because that was deemed to be beneficial to the society, to Russian society. Now, were they wrong?
They were wrong from our perspective. They were right from their perspective. That's why I think it's a relative morality.
But if you have relative morality, then if somebody goes out in the streets of London tonight and rapes and kills a woman, from their perspective, they may think it's right.
Yeah.
But who are you, or who is the society to say that they were wrong?
Well, the society as a whole. That's the thing. The society says it's wrong because that act of one individual isn't beneficial to society. So whether or not they were under the impression that it is beneficial to society, it's not beneficial for the whole society as a whole. And going on back on the topic of if we allowed murder, you'd get the survival of the fittest. Well, you wouldn't, because the fact is, if we allowed murder, they would be competing against the people who are left over, the strong. The strong, yes, they kill off the weak, and then they kill off themselves.
Well, they may decide there's a point to stop, because, again, using that example, and I think...
That's the development of let's not murder.
No, this is the... It's the key. You're actually saying it's okay to murder if it benefits society. That's what your position is.
If it benefits society, I think, yes, it would be okay to murder, but I don't think there are any for instance, war. One could justify war.
Mm-hmm.
As many people do, and I think the church has a church ethicists have a rule of which wars are ethical,
which are just and which are not.
Yeah, which are just and which are not.
Yeah. But the church has a standard by which to compare it.
Yeah, and so if you've got, say, I mean, I think the invasion of Iraq, even though I think it was done about for the wrong reasons, was a just war, mm-hmm. because we stopped. The killing that we did do stopped the killing that possibly would have come from Saddam Hussein still being alive.
Mm-hmm. But you see this where this is leading you, because what you're saying is, and correct me if I've got this wrong, you're saying that if it benefits society, it's allowable. How we determine whether it benefits society or not is really dependent on who are society. So that, for example, you had this whole argument for eugenics, you had this whole argument... Hitler and the Nazis. How could you have family men who looked after their kids and played Mozart on the piano go off to their daytime work manning the ovens in Belsen? Only because in their minds they had come to accept that the Jews were rats. They should just be exterminated as any other rat. And they came to believe that, and society told them that. Now, I'm saying to you that whatever society says, that was wrong. And I think, as a Christian, I have the basis to say that. What you're really telling me is you're arguing for a relative morality, which really means that only the rich and powerful can determine what morality is. And that's one of the reasons I'm a Christian.
I wouldn't say the rich and powerful. I'd say whoever's obviously loud enough in society.
The rich and powerful.
Okay. Yeah, in some, or Hitler obviously started off extremely poor. He was in poverty, and he just did loads of speeches, and he spoke out against things, and he got more popular and more popular and more popular. He started quite small and just became this massive, powerful figure. And I think you've got society where obviously the German society did think that the Jews were pigs and were scum. And that's their society's morality. We now think differently.
But
at the time, if you were in Germany at the time, you would have thought the same thing. That's,
no.
It's a different... I think you would have.
No, you wouldn't, you see. And this is this idea of progression. Actually, human beings at the time didn't think that. It's not that we thought the Jews were like that and now we don't. This inevitable progression. In actual fact, probably the majority of people in Germany didn't think like that. But as Germany in particular... You know, the people who supported Hitler most in Germany were the academics and the scientists. Because they'd entered this brave new world. I mean, it's interesting. Again, you see the morality. You have, and I have to say, confess this in terms of Richard Dawkins. I think he's very fair. These are quotes that come from his book. He says this of H.G. Wells. Oh, sorry, of Thomas Huxley, who had the debate with Wilberforce. Mm. No rational man, cognizant of the facts, believes that the average Negro is the equal, still less the superior of the white man. Or... H.G. Wells, when he's talking about the inferior races, such as the black, the yellow man, in his book The New Republic, says, well, the world is a world and not a charitable institution, and I take it they will have to go. Now, there he's advocating, it's a scientific... Now, Dawkins says, of course, that was the view at the time, the general view, and we've progressed. It wasn't the general view. The point was that William Wilberforce and others believed, wait a minute, these people are made in God's image. They are human beings. Therefore, slavery is wrong. So you had the sort of liberal scientific elite saying the other way, yeah.
We're going to have to just take a quick pause here, gents, and we'll allow Adrian to come back on that. Fascinating stuff. I've just been sitting here listening with great interest, as I'm sure if you're listening to the show today, you are too. If you want to respond to anything you've heard on the show today, the usual methods apply. unbelievable@premier.org.uk is the email address. And if you'd like to phone your comment through, it's 08456 52 52 52 and select option 5 to leave me a voicemail message. And I'm happy to play that out or read out your email next week. Do join us again in a couple of minutes' time. Welcome back. Before we get back to our discussion with David Robertson, Adrian Hayter, let me say next week, the resurrection of Jesus Christ. We're going to be doing 2 weeks. The first week looking at a Muslim perspective, the second week an atheist perspective. And we're delighted to have Shabir Ali, one of the best known Muslim scholars, joining me next week as he argues against the resurrection of Jesus Christ. He claims that Jesus never actually died on the cross. We'll be hearing the response from Canadian Christian apologist Tony Costa next week as he puts the facts of the resurrection to Shabir. You don't want to miss this one. That's from 2:30 next week and online, of course, at premier.org.uk/unbelievable.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back, and we're talking about the myths of atheism. That's the subtitle, if you like, of David Robertson's book, The Dawkins Letter, Challenging Atheist Myths. And we're asking today, what about the myth of godless morality? And that's been really the topic of the first part of this programme. Also going to be getting into the myth of the immoral Bible and the cruel Old Testament God. That's all part of what's coming up on the show today as we have David Robertson and Adrian Hayter in conversation. OK, Adrian, something we kind of diverted from quite early on in the programme was this question of child abuse, religious child abuse. What do you make of Dawkins' assertion that to teach our children about God, or that God is true, or, and that you know, the Bible should be read literally and that kind of thing? Does that for you fall under the category of child abuse?
No, I would argue against Dawkins in that manner. I think... What I hope he was trying to come across, I'm not sure if he was, what I think would constitute child abuse is presenting a view to a child and saying, well, this is what we believe, and then just saying, and you know, and that's unquestionable, you can't question that, and there are no other views that are even up for debate. I think that would constitute as almost child abuse, because what you're doing is you're closing the child's mind to this thing. And I am very thankful for my parents for not doing that. They said, well, we're Christians, this is what we believe. We believe the Bible, we believe in certain things in the Bible. But, you know, that's not the end of the argument. You can go to school and you will learn science and you will learn all these things in history that may make you question the Bible and stuff like that. And so I think that's one of the, obviously a very important aspect of my early life was the fact that I could question these things. And I think Dawkins makes a good point that in the introduction to his book that his wife, Lulla Ward, went to a school she didn't like, and years afterwards she admitted to her parents, and they were like just flabbergasted, really. It's like, why didn't you tell us? And it's like, well, I never knew I could, you know, speak out against it. I think you get a better society and definitely better arguments and discussions if we had parents who would tell the children their beliefs. Sure, tell you, of course, you're going to tell your children your beliefs. You want them to believe the same as you do. But if you open their minds as well to debate and stuff like that, which is why, I mean, yeah. I think...
A close-minded Christian is it's a sad thing, in a way, and I think you'd probably broadly agree there with Adrian.
Yeah, I totally agree with Adrian. I appreciate what he says, and I totally agree with him.
Yeah.
No problem.
What's your view, then, of what Dawkins does say? Does Dawkins take it a level beyond that, then, in your opinion,
yes.
in what he says in the book?
Yes, I think that... I think Dawkins is such a fundamentalist at this level that he thinks that people who do not believe what he believes are either idiots or evil. And, I mean, they're deluded, the God delusion. So, or they are evil. They are propagating something that they know to be false to try and manipulate and use. And it's this vehemence about children. Now, I think that one of the things that really annoys him is there's so many of his own students who are Christians as well. I mean, it's the Christian church in Britain is growing particularly amongst younger people. And that for me is a fascinating thing. My own church, we can't get older people to come. You know, we've gone from 7 people to about 150, and 90% of them are younger than me. And it's quite remarkable that that's happening. And many of them are growing up with an atheist background. Now, I agree. See, I think what Adrian said was spot on. We have a Christianity Explored group, and one gentleman came and I asked him what his religious background was, and he said, actually, my parents were atheists, I was brought up as an atheist, but I'm beginning to have my doubts. And I laughed, and in Christian terms said to him, an atheist backslider, that's wonderful. So, I completely endorse what Adrian says, that you should be brought up to think for yourself.
Mm.
Definitely, I agree with that.
Great. I mean, well, there's one area we agree in, at least. Yeah. I mean, coming back to what we finished off up in the last section.
Well, yes, David made an argument... Which I find a bit confusing in the book. It was, you know, the Bible teaches that man and woman were made in the image of God. Yeah, that's fine. And that was the reason for the church being opposed to the slave trade and everything like that. And you know, he was like saying almost like, oh, if they'd read the Bible, they would, you know, the evolutionists sort of whatever would have realized that, you know, this Negroes weren't, you know, they shouldn't, the slave trade was wrong. The fact was that at the time, people didn't believe that Negroes were humans. They believed that they were just animals. They believed that the Genesis didn't apply to them. So it's not that they read the Bible. They thought, yeah, man and woman were made in the image of God. But they thought image of God just refers to the Caucasian race. Darwin, in his writings, when he was on the Beagle, he went to dinner with a man who was in the slave trade, and he had a load of slaves. And he... at some point, I'm quoting out of memory here, but at some point, the slave owner beat the slaves and said that he'd separate them and they'd go different, and he'd separate the women from the children and everything just because of one little incident. And Darwin wrote about this and how he argued with Fitzroy, Captain Fitzroy, over this and almost got chucked off the Beagle, something like this. And it was, you know, Darwin's theory says that we're all related, so, you know, humans must be related to Negroes, even if Darwin did believe that Negroes were a lesser race or anything like that. We were related. That's what the evolutionary theory says.
I mean, as I say, I don't want to spend too much time going around this, but I mean, any way you can resolve what you feel the major difference is here?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I'm sorry, Adrian, but the history is entirely wrong. I mean, I would love to see... I belong to a church which loves the Puritans. I've read the Puritans. I've read Jonathan Edwards in the States. I've read... most of the major 17th century, 18th century theologians. I've never come across the view that Africans were not human. Never. I would love to see documentary evidence for that. It's precisely the opposite. That is why Wilberforce was so motivated, because he said these are creatures made in God's image the same as we are. And I mean, this is a case of the whole thing being turned on its head and Dawkins getting away with the big lie. He says it's because of evolutionary biology we now recognise all human beings are the same. Actually, biblical Christians have always taught that every human being descended from Adam and Eve. And whatever else, whether you accept that as myth or whatever, every human being is in Adam. And Adam and Eve are made in the image of God. Male and female, he created them. So it is absolutely controverting all the facts. And I want to see evidence for that statement. I guess
my school history course was a bit off
yeah,
then.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
obviously, as a historian,
I am a historian, and I don't dispute that there were some people who would have argued in those lines, and even that, again, in the kind of nominal Christianity, that may well have been a view.
Yeah.
But of course, after Darwin, what happened was more and more people, like H.G. Wells, like Huxley, they believed this. It was the size of your skull, it was, you know, the shape of your skull, and things like that. And they did believe in the genetic superiority of the white race. Many Christians bought into that. You know, to be fair, the Church of England had slaves. You know, I mean, there was a lot of things that were wrong. But the one thing you could not argue was that was because of biblical theology. The church wasn't biblical enough. That was the problem.
Well, let's move on, because if you want to hear another discussion on the concept of morality and whether we need God, if you like, to know what that we have a moral basis, a moral foundation, you know, I would point you in the direction of the show from a couple of weeks ago. Timothy Keller has a very interesting interaction with Norman Backrack on that subject, another one you might want to listen back to. But let's move on, gentlemen. And we've just got about 15 minutes to deal with this. So, you know, I'm sure we'll get it wrapped up in that time. The myth of the immoral Bible and the cruel Old Testament God. Let's start with you, Adrian. For you, what is your view of the Bible? Do you think of the Bible as an immoral book? Do you think of the God represented in the Old Testament as a cruel and immoral dictator, as probably Richard Dawkins would refer?
Well, I mean, I'm no Bible scholar, and ironically enough, David has had, as he mentions in his book, he has more experience studying the Bible than I've actually been alive. I think he could probably make a obviously correct me in a few fallacies if I make them, and I apologise in advance if I do. But I mean, from what I've read of the Bible, and obviously certain elements of it are moral. Obviously, you could thou shalt not kill. I think that's quite moral. And thou shalt not steal. I think that's quite moral. But I think a lot of the Old Testament comes across to me as just really a very, very vindictive God, a very, very aggressive God, one that creates humans with a free will. They're tricked by a serpent, represented by Satan or whatever he wants to explain that, into eating this, going against God and anything like that. And then he decides to punish them for something he gave them. He gave them free will. And I just see that as, well, you know, that's kind of like I guess Ricky Gervais says, you know, don't have the serpent or don't have the tree. It's an accident waiting to happen. which I think, you know, whilst being funny, it's kind of true as well. It's like, you know, it's almost like set up a thing. And if he's meant to be omniscient, as many Christians do believe, then how did he not see that coming? I mean, that's my approach. I think there are a lot of immoral things you could say about the Bible, especially the God of the Bible.
So, on that level, that the God as presented in the Bible doesn't appear to be fair, doesn't appear to be, it seems to have weighed the scales against humans, if you like.
Or at least set everything up so they were going to fail anyway. But
what's your response to that particular way of looking at things, David?
Well, I mean, Adrian, it's an extremely common way of understanding, you know, and I can understand why it is. I find it, there's a delicious irony in here that people judge the Bible by Christian standards. You have to look at the Bible, how it was written and the context in which it was written and what it actually says. And one of the things that is very clear on is God is just. So I start from the assumption God is just. He's not going to do anything unjust. Secondly, I work on the assumption that God is all-knowing, and I'm not. And I may be seeing things that, wait a minute, I don't understand how that's right, how that's fair. But the emphasis for me would be on I don't understand. Not, it's not fair until you prove it to me that's fair, because I'm not God. I'm not in a position to sit in judgment upon God. The free will argument, well, yes, God did see it coming. He is omniscient. And that's the whole teaching of the Bible, that he prepared a plan of redemption. The free will argument is really, really important, because in order for people to have free choice, they have to be able to choose something. If you say, well, you can choose, but if you choose the wrong thing, I'm going to give you the right thing anyway, it's not a choice. The illustration I've heard used, and I saw this in a drama, and I was actually very taken with it from a logical point of view, is imagine a boy who's got a pigeon, his pet pigeon, and he's speaking to one of his pals, and he says, look, my pigeon loves me. And he says, look, he throws it up in the air, and he's got a piece of string tied to the pigeon's leg, and he says, when I call my pigeon, it comes back to me. So throws the pigeon up in the air, calls to the pigeon, coo, coo, whatever, pulls him back in. Says, look, he comes back to me. His friend says, no, he didn't come back to you. You pulled him back. Cut the string. Then we'll see if he really loves you. I think that in order, God could have made us the equivalent of tables or chairs. He could have made us as many, but not all, many scientists believe in genetic determinism. I don't. I don't believe in determinism in that way at all. I believe in two things that are paradoxes. I believe in the sovereignty of God, and I believe in human free will. And in order for us to have free will, we had to be able to choose. And that God could not then say, well, if you choose, then you don't have to bear the consequence of it. I personally don't want to be a chair. It's, again, it's like a child. There's a way that I could prevent my children taking drugs, meeting bad people, and so on. I could lock them in their rooms for 24/7. They're going to grow up stunted and not developed human beings. In order for us to grow as human beings, there has to be elements of choice and elements of risk. And that to me, is a great explanation of... Sorry, that sounds incredibly arrogant, but I didn't mean I've given a great explanation. But for me as a human being, understanding that God... Now, the question then becomes not why did God allow it, but what's he done about it? And then that moves on to the whole question of Jesus and so on. But that would be the...
Does that satisfy it?
I think this is the section of the discussion where, you know, I'm obviously unprepared because I haven't done as much biblical study, and it's very interesting. And it's going to be more of David explaining to me all these how you'd view it from a Christian perspective. What was most intriguing is that David argues against determinism, and I also would argue against determinism. I don't think there is such thing as determinism, but that's another philosophical debate. But the fact is, if God is omniscient and he knows everything that's going to happen, then how is that not determinism? Because everything is going to happen the way God foresees it.
Well, because then now we're getting into really heavy stuff.
And, yes.
Go and read Augustine's City of God if you want your head done in. Or Plantinga or someone. But no, what we're saying there is things occur within space and time. Mm-hmm. But God is both within space and time and out with it. So knowing that things are going to happen. I mean, it's for example, I could put out for my young child a chocolate bar or some prunes and say, you've got a choice. She's going to take the chocolate bar. I know her. I know, you know. Well, and I'm limited in my knowledge. Does she still have the choice? Am I making her take that bar? No. So for me, it's the same aspect in terms of God. I do think there are aspects of genetic determinism which are, you know, that is it true that redheads are all bad tempered? I don't think so, but I think there are genetic factors do come into our makeup. But I'm still wanting to argue, because we're made in God's image, there's an element of rationality and free choice, and that explains an enormous area of the Bible. Once you grasp this aspect, it doesn't explain everything, and it doesn't resolve all the difficulties. And I would be lying if I said that. But it certainly sets it in a much wider context. The notion of God as some kind of chess player moving people around, whether they want to or not, is wrong, okay, biblically.
But, I mean, the one problem I see with that is that you're immediately posing some kind of limit on God, because, so you believe in a limited God. Then,
no. Yes, because here's the interesting thing. Again, and Richard Dawkins, he uses an argument here. Now, he should know this. He's an Oxford professor, so he should know this. The notion that God can do everything. I mean, there's an old moral philosophical question. Can God create a stone heavier than he can lift?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you can play those kind of games. I tell the story in my own book of a child in the Sunday school who the teacher said, is there anything that God cannot do in the Sunday school? And the wee boy puts his hand up and says, yes. She says, no, is there anything that God cannot do? Everyone else is going, no, God can do anything. And this wee boy says, yes. And she said, well, what? He said, lie. God cannot do something that is inconsistent with his own nature. He can't create a square circle, and he can't lie. Once you to go beyond that, you end up... Now, so what we're saying is that God is all-powerful, mm-hmm. God is all-knowing, yes, but within the nature of his own being, if you want to put it that way. Otherwise, yeah. It just becomes nonsense.
And okay, yeah.
Does are these kind of arguments ones that particularly resonate with you then when you read The God Delusion? Richard Dawkins does spend a fair amount of time, Adrian, going into some of the parts of the Old Testament, which he finds repellent. And he has, right at the start of the book, I think, this quite long description of God as...
Chapter 3,
it's kind of, you know, vindictive, murdering... whatever sort of thing. I mean, how do you think he goes too far there? Do you not believe that really represents what Christians believe and what the Bible teaches about God?
Well, yeah. I mean, as David says in his book, I mean, you know, he's got this long sentence that is pretty much an aggressive attack on something he doesn't believe exists. You know, it's like, why is this? Could he possibly think it does exist? Maybe. I think personally, it's. It was probably done for a soundbite. he probably believes it, but not in the sense that he's just writing it down there just to put it out. I think he's just thinking, well, these are some nice words, they go together, and it'll draw people into the chapter a bit more.
Mm. So he's sort of saying it for effect.
It's kind of it's effect, I don't think. You know? He gets a large round of applause every time he says it, so I think it's become something he says quite often.
That's exactly
but right. I don't think he's saying it because, you know, he's trying to be, he hates the God that he doesn't believe in or anything like that. But I think he's just, you know, it's something that...
But presumably he's saying, if the Christian God did exist, I wouldn't want to worship him, frankly, because he's... As far as I can see, he's X, Y, Z, and the other thing.
Yeah.
I mean, and is that your view? I mean, if this Christian God did exist, if you could show me that really God did exist and that he is the God of the Bible, well, he still wouldn't be a God I'd want to worship because of the things he does in the Bible and that sort of thing.
Well, I mean, this is the question that's put to atheists quite often. You know, what if the Christian God is real? And you go up Judgment Day, everything like that, and you're standing in front of him, you know, what would you do? And I think if that happened, and I was an atheist at the end of my life, and that happened, I would have a number of questions, you know. I was like, why didn't you, you know, reveal yourself more in modern times in which I lived? Why didn't you, or, you know, why did you write such a book that can be interpreted in so many different ways by so many different people? And that, you know, it would be easier if... You knew at the beginning of time, you said in Genesis 1, and lo, there was a big bang in the heavens, and all the planets sprung forth, or something like that. And then, you know, you'd get physics in modern times saying, oh, yes, well, this completely agrees with our current view, you know.
Dave, is that fair enough? I mean, I think that's what Bertrand Russell said, wasn't it?
Yeah.
If you met God, what would you say? And you say, why didn't you give me more evidence, God?
Well, let me put it this way. I think when you meet God... you won't say anything, but that's another issue.
Speechless, I think.
I understand that. But for example, Genesis 1 does say the Big Bang. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. It certainly wasn't a whimper. The interesting thing about the Big Bang is, until Big Bang theory was discovered, majority of scientists would have believed in the eternity of matter rather than God. Big Bang theory was a godsend to the church because the Big Bang said the universe had a beginning. That's what Genesis said. Now, Dawkins' argument is, well, it's a 50-50 chance of getting it right. So just so what if the Bible got that right? But it's even more. I mean, the other thing that's there that's very interesting, you're talking about more information. You're a computer. You know far more about computers than I do. John Lennox, and I strongly recommend his book, has Science Disproved God, God's Undertakers, Science Killed God. He argues that we now know in science that everything contains information. Everything is coded. We also know, it's a scientific axiom, that codes are put in So, you know, it's another argument from design, if you like, if the codes are there. So Paul in Genesis 1 said, what may be known about God is plain to people, but people choose to suppress that. So again, we come back to the premise of the first program, which is, I think most people are atheists, not as an intellectual thing, but as an emotional reaction. And part of it is a reaction against the God of the Bible, and part of it is a misunderstanding that the God of the Old Testament is cruel. Jesus Christ is a kind of cool hippie guy, but you know, we wouldn't want that. Whereas I think if you actually get to know the Bible, yes, there are very difficult passages in both the Old and New Testament. Jesus teaches about hell, for example, more than anyone. But overall, I think the caricature, and it is a caricature, that Dawkins puts is wrong, and you can't go by caricatures. You have to find for yourself. So that's why I appreciate your attitude.
It's a lovely amicable end to the programme there. But, and I'm going to sort of just wrap things up there, because we're unfortunately out of time. Just as I give again the details for how people can get in touch, just want you guys to think up 30 seconds of just some final thoughts on the two shows that you've been involved in. It's been fantastic having you on the programme. Well, if you'd like to respond yourself to anything you've heard today, you're more than welcome to get in touch. As I say, the email address is, of course, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and you can phone your comment through on 08456 52 52 52, select option 5. Don't forget, this programme available now as a podcast. Do tell your friends. premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Perhaps you know someone who would be interested in listening.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, just some final thoughts then from David and Adrian. David, just as we finish, anything you'd like to leave with the listener and with Adrian?
Yeah, just to say, Adrian, I very much appreciated talking to you. I've appreciated your openness and your ability to think about things. And I guess I would encourage you to continue what you said in terms of being open-minded and looking at things. And I hope I will do the same. And I will certainly continue to read your blog. I guess my thing would be to say, we all look at things through a prism. And my prism is Jesus Christ. And I would say, find out who Jesus Christ is. Get to know who he is. You can't reject what you don't know, so get to find out. And I think that you know, I will pray. You'd say prayer doesn't work because there isn't a God. I will pray that God shows you something. My atheist friend from the Dawkins website, who became a Christian, described it to me this way. He said it was the words, "We love him because he first loved us," that changed everything for him. And he said, my life changed from being a two-tone black and white world to being a multicolor, three-dimensional world. That's my prayer for you and for anyone else who's listening. And I do really appreciate the manner in which you've conducted this. And I do appreciate your blog. Thank you.
Adrian, final thoughts?
Yeah, well, it's been an absolute pleasure meeting David and discussing things with you. And I'd just like to thank Premier Christian Radio for obviously inviting me on. It was kind of like 2 weeks ago I got an invite. And I was like, oh, my. How did they find me?
And well, there's this little thing called the internet.
Yes.
And you use it quite a lot. So,
but yeah, and I just really, I'd like to make pretty much just a plea to any atheists who have read The God Delusion to get a copy of David's book, because I honestly think it is an extremely well-structured and verbose argument. And obviously it refutes several of Dawkins' points. And obviously, if you're a free thinker and you claim to be a free thinker, you can't just read one book, God Delusion, and think, oh, well, that's it, I'm not going to read anything else. So if there's one book I would suggest reading alongside The God Delusion, it would be this one. And conversely, if you are a Christian listening, I would ask you, you know, question your beliefs, read The God Delusion, okay, and read David's book and see where you stand.
Well, thank you so much, gentlemen, both, for being with me on the programme. And do check out the websites of our respective guests on the programme today. You can find David at, would you give me the web address for the church, David?
Yes,
and people want to find out more.
You can go to www.freechurch.org, that's all one word, and you'll find a link to St. Peter's. You can Google St. Peter's, St. Peter's Dundee, and you will get a direct link to our website.
Great.
As well. So.
You have multiple websites, Adrian, so tell me the one that you would direct people to.
If you just Google Adrian Hayter or Atheist Blogger, or go to atheistblogger.com, that's my main
blog.
That's
where you are, and you can find your way from there. Thanks so much again, gents, for being with me. Thank you for listening, and I do hope you've enjoyed the programme. Do get in touch and do let others know about it. The webpage, again, is unbelievable. It's premier.org.uk/unbelievable. We'll see you again at the same time next week. You're unbelievable. First of 2 weeks looking at the resurrection of Jesus Christ, looking at a Muslim perspective first of all next week with Shabir Ali, one of the best known Muslim scholars in the world. You won't want to miss this, as he tells us why he doesn't believe Jesus rose from the dead, because he doesn't believe Jesus actually died on the cross. Fascinating interaction next week with Canadian Christian apologist Tony Costa, as he puts the facts of the resurrection to Shabir. You won't want to miss it. 2:30 p.m. here on Premier Christian Radio, or online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable.